All right, we continue our study of Calvin's life, and we're dealing with a couple of special areas of concern with regard to the first part of his life, and that's one was Calvin's conversion. The second is his character. One of the classic stories about Calvin is that during his student days, he was known as the accusative case. If you ever want to make somebody mad, call them the accusative case. If they have a, even if they don't know Greek or Latin, they will understand what you're saying when you call them the accusative case. Now, and you shouldn't be thinking that about your mother right now, Alex. I'm sorry. Never mind. Your faithful mother. It's symptomatic of the injustice done to Calvin's character that perhaps the most well-known story about Calvin's student days is that he was known as the accusative case by his fellow students because he was always censoring their morals. This, as far as can be determined, has no factual basis whatsoever and is total mythology. Unfortunately, even Owen Chadwick cites this story as if it were authentic. Scarce as information about Calvin's student days is, one thing is clear from the correspondence of Calvin during those years. Both in Paris and in Orléans, he was on intimate terms with a circle of friends whom he regarded and by whom he was regarded with deep affection. These letters reveal that the stoical, cynical, and unfriendly Calvin, who is a loner and an enemy of all mankind, is a creature of myth and not history. One biographer, I don't know how to say this name, so I'll do my best, Dumergu or Domergue, something like that, notes that the fact that many of Calvin's early associates eventually joined him at Geneva speaks against this myth. It was the finest and noblest at the universities who were attracted to Calvin. It is, of course, possible that some would not be so attracted to Calvin. Whatever truth was perverted into the story about the accusative case is stated by Beza, well, Warfield concurs. It must be noted in conclusion that this view of Calvin the student is especially suited to give us an accurate and just idea of his character. It is unjust to draw our conclusions about someone's native character when he is sick and the butt of tremendous opposition, persecution, and mockery. And this was, in fact, Calvin's lot throughout his days in Geneva. Calvin the student shows us the native disposition of the man. If there is not the majesty of the later Calvin, neither is there the occasional irritability which gave rise to the myth of Calvin's character as misanthropic, that is to say, not friendly to mankind. Misanthropic. All right, that brings us then to Roman numeral 2, the middle period of Calvin's life, which we can subtitle Exiled Wanderer. And during this period, we follow him through Basel, where he is in 1535 to 36, Geneva, 1536 to 1538. Yes, did you know that he was in Geneva twice? And we'll tell you the rest of that story sometime soon. And then Strasbourg, 1538 to 1541. So first of all, Basel. In 1535, when he was 26, he wrote the Institutes. Think about that. Now, there are some qualifications that go into that. But not that many that is still not really impressive. He was 26 when he wrote the book for which he is most well known and probably the most used systematic theology in the history of the Christian church. Calvin probably began or continued his study of Hebrew after he settled in Basel. Again, God in his providence gave him one of the great professors of Hebrew in that day, a man by the name of Sebastian Münster. This was not his sole or even his most important occupation at that time. By August 23 of 1535, when he finished the preface, he had completed the first edition of the Institutio Christianae Religionis. It was published by March of 1536. Now, a few things about the Institutes. First of all, its pressing occasion. The reason Calvin wrote the Institutes was the slanderous misrepresentation of Protestants by King Francis I, and especially of French Protestants. Of course, he had done this to justify his persecution of them. You recall that about 200 French Protestants were martyred as a result of the Placard incident. Several of these were close to Calvin, including Étienne de la Forge of Paris. King Francis I justified his action to the German Protestant princes, with whom he had an important political alliance, by claiming that those he was persecuting were revolutionary Anabaptists. Oh, they're not like you German Protestants at all. Right. This was claimed in February of 1535, and this slander, threw Calvin into the midst of the battle. His duty was clear. He could not permit this blatant misrepresentation of his friends, who were actually true martyrs for God and not some sort of fanatics like Francis I was claiming. He quickly completed the book. The first half seems to have been already completed before he reached Basel. To the book, he added a letter addressed to King Francis I as an apology for the Protestant cause. The book itself would show that the French Protestants were not Anabaptist, and thus the Institutes were both an apology and a confession of faith. The preface is one of the finest pieces of apology. Its argument is powerful in its incisive legal conclusiveness. His turning of the fathers against the Catholics is classic. And you can note, to see more of this, pages 28 to 31 of the Institutes. I think that's the foreword of it anyway. Oh, original purpose. So the original purpose of this greatest of all systematic theologies, the original purpose of the Institutes was for it to be a handbook on Christian doctrine intended for every serious Christian. Parker cites the original preface in proof of this. The basic teaching of the Christian religion, comprising almost the whole sum of godliness and whatever it is necessary to know in the doctrine of salvation. A newly published work, very well worth reading by all who are students of godliness. The practical character of the Institutes is illustrated by the fact that it followed the format of a catechism. Specifically, the first edition of the Institutes followed the format of Luther's catechism of 1529, which, by the way, is indicative of the immense influence that Luther had on Calvin. In a sense, I think Calvin would have thought of himself as the systematizer of Luther. Its remarkable success. The remarkable success of the Institutes was first marked by a considerable sale, and within a year, a new edition was needed. Much could be said of the importance of the Institutes. This is epitomized in the fact that just as the oldest commentaries on most of your shelves are Calvin's commentaries, so also the oldest systematic theology is Calvin's Institutes. Of course, the remarkable character of this achievement is only enhanced by the fact that Calvin was only 25 or 26 when he completed it. The points just made are tremendously instructive, especially with reference to the question of the truth path to usefulness and eminence in the gospel ministry. The Institutes catapulted Calvin into the position of the recognized leader of the French Reformation. Calvin's eminence was the result not of the attempt to write the greatest systematic theology ever written, but the very practical result of his zeal for the work of God and a desire to give a simple handbook to God's people so that they might progress in grace. See the godliness of his purpose and the servant-like character of his purpose as well. That's a rebuke to our grand designs and lofty ambitions. I want to write a great book. No, please don't do that. If you ever really have a call from God, try to write a useful book. Here's the true path to usefulness: zeal for God, a heart for instructing God's common people, and an eye for the pressing needs of God's kingdom. And this is what Calvin wrote. What was the first edition of the Institutes? An apology, a confession, and a handbook. not a lofty theological treatise, may we learn to seek in humble ways God's glory, the furtherance of his kingdom, the good of his people. Now, all of this brings us to something that, again, you may or may not be aware of, but there was a tremendous organic growth to the institutes over the years. From 1535 to 1559, when the last Latin edition of it was printed, Calvin revised the institutes 7 times. And you might even argue more, because a lot of those revisions he then translated into French, and I can only imagine it was difficult to keep himself from even improving it when he was translating it into French, okay? So he revised the institutes 7 times in Latin from 1535 to 1559. And so in a real sense, the institutes was Calvin's life work. And much changed about the book over these years of revision. It increased in size 500% from the first edition, so it was 5 times as large by 1559. The first edition was 6 chapters. The last edition was 80 chapters. It went from approximately 300 pages in length to about 1,500 pages, depending on how you print it, of course. This format was greatly altered over the years. The format with which we are familiar only came into existence, in fact, with the last revision. The 4 books, one, you know, based on the Nicene Creed's Confession of the Father, the second based on the Nicene Creed's Confession of the Son, the third based on the Nicene Creed's Confession of the Spirit, and the fourth based on I Believe in the Church, right? That format only came into existence with the last revision. The first edition had 6 chapters which respectively dealt with the law, the Ten Commandments, the faith, the Apostles' Creed, prayer, the Lord's Prayer, the sacraments, the false sacraments, and together in the last chapter, Christian liberty, church government, and civil government. Over the years, the original chapter on the Apostles' Creed was enlarged and divided many times. In the last edition, it became the organizing principle of the whole book. All of the rest of the enlarged content was fitted into the framework of the Creed, of the Father, of His Son, of the Holy Spirit, of the Holy Catholic Church. This final edition was more than twice the size, in fact, of its immediate predecessor. Only with it was Calvin satisfied with the organization of what had become his life work. The general purpose of the institutes also changed over the years. Originally a handbook for all Christians, it became a textbook for theological students and was widely used as such. Side by side with this enlarged purpose, Calvin intended the second and subsequent editions of the institutes as a companion volume to his commentaries. Thus, he avoided the necessity of taking up doctrinal themes in his commentaries and could maintain their brevity. Believe it or not, and I think we should believe it, because there are a lot of commentaries that are much longer. Even back in that day, Bucer and other guys write these humongously long commentaries on books of the Bible. The reason is that they were, when they get to a verse on a certain subject, they'd pour the whole Bible into that verse and the whole of its theology into that single verse. Calvin determined when he was writing commentaries he would not do that. He determined that he would make the Institutes the companion volume to all his commentaries. So when he wrote his first commentary on Romans, it's comparatively brief, and at point after point after point, though he doesn't say it explicitly, he's assuming that you've got the Institutes, and if you want to know more about a certain theological subject that comes up, you can read about it in the Institutes. So he wrote brief commentaries, and that's probably one of the reasons why they've had such a lasting usefulness. Now, although all of this may be said by way of emphasizing the changes over the years, one thing about the Institutes did not change, never changed. Its doctrine. In the 1539 edition, which had doubled in size over the original, it may be said that the theology of the Institutes reached its maturity. Unlike Augustine, Calvin never retracted anything. Though his work was incomplete, Calvin never changed his doctrinal convictions from the first edition. E, its historical origins. Very much might be said about the historical influences on Calvin's thought as reflected in the Institutes. I simply want to mention the two influences, the two men, who are of most direct importance. Even though Calvin denies Luther's doctrine of consubstantiation, he is profoundly influenced by Luther, as we're going to see. His entire presentation of the doctrine of salvation in Book 3 is an extended elaboration and defense of the centrality of sola fide in salvation. So the doctrine of conversion and justification is Luther's. The significant order of law, then faith, is Luther's and derived from his catechism. Even though Calvin distances himself from consubstantiation, he is more sympathetic with Luther's doctrine of the Eucharist than Zwingli's. Interestingly enough. The other man whose influence is clearly discerned even in the first, but especially in the second and subsequent revisions of the Institutes, is Bucer. We have seen that early in the 1530s, Calvin was on intimate terms with Bucer, the reformer of Strasbourg. Bucer occupied an intermediate position between Luther of the Lutherans and Zwingli of the Swiss. He was intensely desirous of unifying the Protestant Reformation. Calvin's mediating doctrine of the Lord's Supper is appropriate to Bucer's position. It is, however, especially in Calvin's doctrine of predestination that Bucer is discernible. Calvin's pietistic use of election and its central position in his theology is derived, it appears, from Bucer. Now, when I say all of this, it strikes me that there's one qualification that is maybe not as clear here as it should be, and it's this. I'm talking about contemporary influences, okay? Contemporary influences. If you simply go and read the first book of the Institutes, you will see that as to writers who are actually cited, Augustine is cited far more than anyone else. And so that's the qualification here. Contemporary influences, it's Luther and Bucer. But in terms of church fathers, if you include them, you'd have to mention Augustine as well. All right, that brings us to Calvin's travels during this period. Around the time that the Institutes were published in March of 1536, Calvin left Geneva to visit Italy. Two motives may be discerned for Calvin's visit to Italy. As a humanist, I'm struggling. 1536, left Geneva. I wonder if I've got a typo there. Well, let's see. As a humanist, there would be a natural desire to see the birthplace of humanism. Perhaps more importantly was the desire to further the work of reform going on there at the court of Ferrara. The Princess Renee was sympathetic to reform, and many French refugees and travelers sympathetic to it had congregated there. The Princess Renee was the daughter of Louis XII and would have been queen and ruler of France except for the French Salic Law forbidding female rulers. And if you're asking yourself the question, no, the English did not have the Salic Law, but the French did. They could not have female rulers. About the time that Calvin arrived, Renee's husband had cracked down on her friends and several had been arrested for Lutheran heresy. Calvin's stay was, therefore, brief. It was long enough, however, to form friendships which were lasting in their spiritual benefits. This again puts the lie to the common misconception of Calvin's character. From Italy, Calvin, with his friend Du Tillet, returned to Basel. Calvin then visited France. Politics had dictated a cessation of the persecutions of the previous year. Calvin's visit to France was brief. After taking care of certain business, he set out for Strasbourg or Basel, accompanied by his brother and sister, Antoine and Marie. The direct route was barred by war. Thus, the Calvins decided on a route that would take them through Geneva by way of Lyon. And now, you know, the rest of the story. Calvin didn't even intend to go to Geneva, but he did, and that changed his life. Geneva, 1536 to 1538. Three things call for consideration here. First, the circumstances of Calvin's introduction into Geneva. Two, the sundry disputes and debates at this time. And three, the rock of offense. First, the circumstances of Calvin's introduction into Geneva. And that leads us to speak, first of all, of the coming of reform. There had been evangelical activity in Geneva since the 1520s. This activity intensified in the 1530s and became involved in the struggles of Geneva for political freedom. So now you've got a religious reformation and political revolution going on at the same time. Or revolution may be too strong a word, but at least a move to political freedom for Geneva. Many different reformers labored for the reformation of Geneva. These included Pierre Viret, Pierre Robert Olivetan, yes, Midnight Oil Pete was there, and most importantly of all, William Farel. The main instrument was Farel. Violence attended the movement to reform. A leading figure in the Roman party was murdered. An attempt was made on Farel's life. An attempt was made to poison the reformers. Pierre Viret became seriously ill as a result. Finally, in 1535, a month-long dispute between Romanist and Reformation theologians resulted in the confounding of the Romanists. In May 1536, the city voted to live by the gospel. And that's what had happened when Calvin showed up. So that brings us to the coming of Calvin. Thus it happened that Calvin arrived incognito in July 1536 at a very auspicious time in the history of Geneva. A friend living at Geneva, probably Du Tillet, informed Farel, because he was coming through and keeping a low profile, just going to stay the night. Farel vigorously importuned Calvin to stay. Thus it happened that an overnight stay became the road to almost all of Calvin's remaining 30-year ministry. Calvin must be allowed to tell the story. The following is from the autobiographical fragment in his preface to his commentary on the Psalms. Wherever else I had gone, I had taken care to conceal that I was the author of the Institutio, and I had resolved to continue in the same privacy and obscurity until at length William Farel detained me at Geneva, not so much by counsel and exhortation as by a dreadful curse, which I felt to be as if God had from heaven laid his mighty hand upon me to arrest me. As the most direct road to Strasbourg, to which I then intended to retire, was shut up by the wars, I had resolved to pass quickly by Geneva without staying longer than a single night in that city. A little before this, popery had been driven from it by the exertions of the excellent man whom I've named, and Pierre Viret. But matters were not yet brought to a settled state, and the city was divided into ungodly and dangerous factions. Then a person who has now basely apostatized and returned to the papists discovered me and made me known to others. That's Du Tillet. Upon this, Farel, who burned with an extraordinary zeal to advance the gospel, immediately strained every nerve to detain me. And after learning that my heart was set upon devoting myself to private studies, for which I wished to keep myself free from other pursuits, and finding that he gained nothing by entreaties, he proceeded to utter the imprecation that God would curse my retirement and the tranquility of the studies which I sought if I should withdraw and refuse to help when the necessity was so urgent. By this imprecation, I was so terror-struck that I gave up the journey I had undertaken. But sensible of my natural shyness and timidity, I would not tie myself to any particular office. So this is what Farel did. He said, if you don't stay here and help me, God's going to curse you, and he's going to curse all that quiet and study that you want to do. Now, how Farel knew that, I don't know. But he did that, and at least Calvin was convinced that it was true. And maybe there was a moral basis for it. Maybe Calvin saw in Farel's vigor and his force and in his curse that he was following a path that was more one of his own desire than of God's leading. I don't know. At any rate, Calvin was terror struck, that's his own word, and by the forceful Pharrell, and decided that he had to stay. Cartier rightly remarks on this as an exhibition of Pharrell's true greatness, because the fact is Pharrell felt he needed Calvin. He didn't ask him to stay for no good reason. Pharrell felt that he was not the one to bring the church state there to a settled condition. He needed the help of someone like Calvin, and he was determined to have his help, which, if nothing else, shows a great deal of humility on Pharrell's part, doesn't it? Calvin, at first, as we have heard him say, held no particular office. 6 months or a year later, he became a stated doctor. In the meantime, he was designated lecturer in theology. After this, he was a pastor. This is important because it shows that Calvin was no doctrinaire theoretician, but through all his days in Geneva, he was a pastor. Now, there were many different debates and disputes involving Calvin during this period at Geneva. There was a debate with some wandering Anabaptists. There was also a dispute in Lausanne, where Calvin used his learning with impressive effect. Calvin spoke and astounded his audience by the abundance of his quotations from the fathers. He's quoting the church fathers at length from memory, and the extent of his patristic learning, in particular on the question of the Lord's Supper. To this period, January 1537, belonged two tracts dealing with the proper attitude of evangelicals to Roman worship. Calvin attacks the temporizing, that means the compromising attitude so prevalent in French Reform. Here we see how far Calvin had departed from French moderatism. Perhaps the most significant dispute of all which belongs to this period is between Calvin and Pharrell on the one hand and Pierre Caroli on the other. It also epitomizes the differences between the moderate French Reform epitomized in Lefebvre and the strict Reform now coming to expression in Pharrell and Calvin. Caroli had fled from France at the time of the affair of the placards. Before that, he had been a preacher for Brichonnet. In 1536, he was appointed pastor of the church in Lausanne, where he began recommending prayers for the dead to his flock. Verrey was reported, this is a typo. It either should read, Verrey reported him to the authorities for this, or it should read that Caroli was reported to the authorities for this. Caroli, going by the famous maxim, you know, the football maxim, the best defense is a good offense, countered by charging Verrey, Calvin, and Pharrell with Arianism. Well, that's, you know, that's always good to change the subject like that. Some seeming ground for this charge had been given by Calvin's and Pharrell's avoidance of technical Trinitarian terminology in certain of their writings. In other writings, such as the Institutes of 1536, Calvin had used the terms of historical theology to describe the Trinity. No real basis existed for Caroli's charge. Caroli demanded that the Genevan reformers subscribe the ancient confessions of the church in order to clear their name. Calvin said, I absolutely will not. Wow. This refusal gave rise to many misgivings in the hearts of their fellow reformers and spotted Calvin's reputation. Why did he refuse to do this? Well, the words of Calvin indicate that he had no respect for the so-called Athanasian Creed. In fact, I think those of you who've been in early church know. He had good reason to not have any respect for the Athanasian Creed, not because it was wrong doctrinally, but because it wasn't a creed, it was a hymn. Because it wasn't Athanasian, it was Augustine, Augustinian. At any rate, it's not that he disbelieved its contents, but he doubted its historicity. Subsequent investigation has, of course, verified his reservations. Calvin may also have objected to Caroli's right to demand subscription. Caroli was dismissed and went back to France. He spent the rest of his life bouncing back and forth between Rome and the Reformed Church, ending his life in the Roman Church. And that brings us to the rock of offense, the discipline of the church in Geneva. The great task laid upon Calvin upon his revival in Geneva was the organizing of the Church of Geneva. It was his attempt to perform this task which would lead to his and Farel's ejection from Geneva in 1538. Much of the later history of Calvin is bound up in the system of church government he now tried to institute in Geneva. So first of all, its historical context. In order to rightly evaluate Calvin's attempt to revamp the Church of Geneva, two related facts concerning the historical context of his attempt must be understood. Medieval states were totalitarian, even republics like Geneva. And if you don't understand that, if you don't get that inside your head, you'll never appreciate what's going on. You say, well, there's no freedom of religion. There's no separation of church and state. Of course not. And there wasn't anywhere in Europe at the time. Okay? So you just have to appreciate that medieval states like Geneva and all of Europe at this time were totalitarian. They were sacral. There was no such thing as separation of church and state, and there was no such thing as religious freedom. And if you hold Calvin to that standard, you are committing an historical anachronism. Medieval states thus attempted to control the public morals. They would have thought you were absolutely nuts if you said that you can't legislate morality. Of course you legislated morality. What else would you legislate? Calvin's attempt to strictly regulate the public morality of Geneva was therefore nothing new. Its basic documents. Three basic documents were involved in Calvin's system of reform. The most important was the document entitled Articles on the Organizing of the Church and Its Worship in Geneva. Out of this document grew two others, the Confession of Faith and a Catechism for the Instruction of Children. If you ever visit Grand Rapids, Michigan, and go to the Calvin College Library, the meter center there, and they let you into their closed air-conditioned room, you may see a 1541 copy printing of the Catechism of Geneva. If I recall right, it's white and it's binding. At any rate, and all sorts of other really interesting rare Calviniana, which is what the meter center is dedicated to. They've tried to collect every piece of writing about Calvin and Calviniana in the Meter Center in Grand Rapids. Wonderful place. I once wrote a paper there for my THM studies. At any rate, council approved the articles. One of the stipulations was that all Genevans would subscribe the confession. So to be a citizen of Geneva, you had to subscribe the confession of faith. This was a point of contention, of course. Its fundamental ideas. This point introduces us to Calvin's doctrine concerning the relation of church and state. It is necessary here to avoid simplistic statements. Calvin's doctrine involved a tension between the freedom and purity of the church on the one hand and the connection between the church and state on the other. Calvin strongly upheld the freedom of the church from state control. Most reformers had fled from the tyranny of the papacy to the control of the state. This is known as Erastianism. Erastianism is related to a kind of, but not the same as, Caesaropapism, the practice of Caesar controlling the church as it was practiced in the Eastern Roman Empire, then the Byzantine Empire. Erastian views are similar. But Calvin rejected both the papal and the Erastian views of the relation of church and state. Look at the chart in your notes. The Erastians said that there was a hierarchy, God, state, church. God gives the highest human authority to the state. State delegates it to the church. The papal view was the mirror image of that. God gives the highest human authority to the church, and they have a controlling influence on the state. The Calvinist view and Calvin's view in Geneva was neither. God was the final authority for both state and church, and neither were higher than the other. The church was free, that is to say, it was not subject to state control. Now, that raises all sorts of very interesting and knotty questions. And I will even plainly tell you that I don't think that Calvin's views are practicable at all. Because you cannot have a state church and a church state without one of the two controlling the other. Calvin's view was that you were to have a free church working together with the state, and yet it was to be free, and yet there was, the state was to make sure that there were no other churches in town. Now, I don't think that could work. I don't think it should work. I don't think it's completely right, but it was certainly what Calvin was doing. However inconsistent and impracticable it was, what Calvin was doing was certainly far more biblical than the Erastianism of Luther's Germany or the papalism of France. All right? Now, the place where this doctrine became excruciatingly concrete and practical was in the regulation of the Lord's Supper. How was the supper to be regulated? Who were to be admitted? Calvin argued that the church had ultimate authority in this matter. For the purity of the church and the protection of the table from profanation, therefore, Calvin wrote several steps into his ruling documents. First, all citizens were to accept the evangelical faith by subscribing the confession. Thus, all adherents of the apostate church would be identified and excluded. Two, overseers would be appointed by the council to watch over public morals in each section of the city. They would be like elders, I guess. Three, these would report all infractions to the ministers, and together with the ministers would have the power of excommunication. But excommunication was only to be done for spiritual causes. On the other hand, Calvin firmly believed in the connection between church and state. The state paid the ministers. The state appointed the elders. Its duty was to defend the true religion. It could punish those with temporal punishment excommunicated by the church. And so you have to understand that, significant as was Calvin's innovation, Calvin's breakthrough, Calvin's insistence on the fact that the church controlled who took the Lord's Supper, as significant as that was, it was not the Baptist or free church system the relationship of church and state. That can be constructed and graphed as follows. The independence but connection of church and state, that's Calvin's view, with God being the authority of both state and church, but state and church being connected, chained together, so to speak. The independence and the separation of the church from the state is the Baptist independent or free church view as it later developed, and it said that God gives the authority both to state and church, but that they are independent. There is, in that view, what we might call sphere sovereignty. Now, there isn't a sense in Calvin's view, and yet the two were so closely linked together that it was difficult to think in those terms. Now, notice finally its failure elsewhere. Calvin's system and his commitment to the discipline and freedom of the church, if not unique among the reformers, was certainly unparalleled in its fervor. Some opposed it. Calvin's motives were intensely pastoral. The consequences, therefore, of Calvin's commitment to the purity of the church would be tremendous. E, its preliminary rejection. Though reform made good progress at first, opposition began to be aroused when the practical crunch was felt. A party arose that admired the looser discipline of the state-controlled church in Bern. Byrne was, by alliance, closely connected with Geneva. About this time, Byrne's ecclesiastical and political leaders attacked the Genevan reformers. They wanted, in particular, to impose uniformity with respect to ceremonies in the church. Calvin resisted the imposition of these ceremonies by the state and promised to await the decision of the Synod of Zurich. Well, as a result of that, Calvin was out. Some efforts were made to reconcile the reformers with Geneva, but Geneva refused. Some of their fellow reformers blamed Calvin for being overly strict in his pursuit of discipline. Well, we'll conclude the second lecture for the evening there. All right, questions? Yes, Ben.
In those days, was everybody required to attend church and take the Lord's Supper and do things like that? I'm just trying to think.
I mean, yeah, it would have been expected that you would attend church. Yes. If you didn't, you would have been subject to some sort of penalties.
Have to be on church,
church
on Sundays.
Now, I'm not sure how well they did in actually enforcing that, okay? But the assumption would be that everybody in Geneva was a member of the church, and that everybody was a good church member. And if you weren't a good church member, if you got yourself excommunicated, that would involve probably temporal issues as well, and you didn't have a right to worship where you wanted. So ultimately, if you rejected the Church of Geneva, you were rejecting Geneva, and you would probably be exiled at best. Only in the sense that theonomy, in some sense, I think still holds a version of the union of church and state. They did, yes. The right term is that they were committed sacralists. That is to say, the idea was that you could have one church in a society, and you could not have more. Any more than one church, any kind of freedom of religion to worship how you want would undermine society. And that's called sacralism. Sacral. No. And in all the Lutheran parts of Germany, there were no Roman Catholic churches. But Germany became a patchwork with some principalities being Catholic and some being Lutheran. If you looked at Germany in terms of this patchwork, yes, it was both Lutheran and Catholic. But we understand that these principalities were committed to their own church, each of them. There was no separation of church and state. The assumption was that if you were a Lutheran principality, you had a Lutheran church and no others, and if you were a Catholic principality, you had a Catholic church and no other. Who were the first advocates of the separation of church and state? Great question. That's Jeremy Brunier. In the Reformed movement, in the Reformed churches, the first advocates of it were the Congregationalists the English Congregationalists, not Jeremy, the American Congregationalist, who did not believe in the separation of church and state, but the English Congregationalists, their English brethren, actually taught the separation of church and state in the 1650s and in the Savoy Declaration. I think certain Anabaptists would have taught the separation of church and state. The problem with citing Anabaptists in this light is that they did not believe that the state was even a divine institution. It was simply a necessary evil. So to speak of the separation of church and state, you have to believe in the divine authority of both, and Anabaptists did not. So the Baptists and the Congregationalists were the Congregationalists were the first Reformed churches in England to teach this, and the original particular Baptist churches arose out of those Congregationalist Puritan churches in the early 1600s. John Ferguson, do you think Augustine had a direct influence on Calvin's view of church and state? Yes, I do. I think it's unquestionable. Other questions? All right, let's take a break. We'll start at about 22 till the hour.